Welcome to CFRI's Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Everyone knows who you are.
All right. Well, hello, everybody. I'm honored to moderate this panel of experts. And hello, all of the wonderful experts that have generously agreed to be on this panel have already been introduced at their respective talks. And so we have Emily Schaller and then Dr. Nadia Islam and Dr. Dave Nichols and Dr. Abigail Garcia and Issa Stenzel Burns. And we will have Dr. Stephen Rowe soon. Hopefully. So this is your panel, and all questions are welcome. Don't be shy or worry about the pronunciation of words. That includes me. Or think that your question is not technical enough. We're a supportive crowd for those of you who haven't been here before. That is very important to know. And then having said this, please avoid making your questions too specific to you or your child's case. And do not name the care team. This isn't a time for, this isn't a time for statements. It's a time to glean insights from this outstanding and diverse panel of experts. And please limit yourself to one question to allow others to ask questions, and you can always get back in line if you do. Everyone should use the mic, and for those with CF, please try to maintain the 6-foot rule while waiting in line, and again, no one should touch the mic. I'll get started with this panel, with a question for the panel, and then open it up to the floor. So I wanted to ask about alternative therapies, or off-label, or outside-of-the-box therapies that maybe you've come across with personally or in clinical experience with your CF patients that have been found to be helpful. So if anyone wants to for example, like what exactly, like maybe probiotics, exactly, you talked about probiotics. Yeah. What kind? I mean, even though that's not really technically alternative therapy, but it's and not outside of the box, but is there a specific type of probiotic that people should look at? Or if anyone else wants to answer about whatever, any other therapies.
So probiotics that we use, I think the widely studied one is the lactobacillus strain, and that's what we mainly use. Yes, I agree it is off-label for constipation and for DOS, but we use it anyway. But I don't think that we have data to support really its use, whether it truly decreases their incidence of exacerbations from these intestinal conditions. I'm not sure we do.
So there's not a specific brand?
No, not necessarily, although there is, at least for kids who have trouble taking them, there's Cultural for Kids, you know, that's easy to take. So that's probably the one that we use most often, but it doesn't mean that we can't use the other bifidobacteria or the VSL1, which comprises of different strains. I mean, we can use them all too.
Okay. Anyone else, something that you found?
Yeah, I think it's always hard to recommend a therapy that hasn't been fully tested in that way, but clearly there are sizable numbers of patients who get a lot of benefit from alternative approaches to their therapies, be it acupuncture or meditation or, you know, many, many find vigorous exercise very helpful, and that is an endorsed activity, of course. It's good for all of us, whether or not we have CF, and the Europeans are very much proponents of exercise as part of daily care and airway clearance, and perhaps we're coming around a little more to that. So beyond that, I think it's a little bit anecdotal, and it would be hard to endorse any of my opinion.
I figured that, but has acupuncture actually been studied in, I know for sinusitis, but for lungs or for other
areas.
Others can comment. It seems to assist with pain management in many ways, and I imagine there have been other studies that I'm not aware of. Yeah.
So I may add too that I mentioned about the common conditions that affect CF patients, but it doesn't mean that they cannot have irritable bowel syndrome or functional abdominal pain. That is also a possibility. So in addition to what you mentioned, yes, we do ask them to go for biofeedback acupuncture, which have been shown to be effective for irritable bowel syndrome. So you shouldn't rule that out completely. I mean, you know, that can still happen.
All right, thank you. All right, we'll go to questions.
Hello, and thank you for being available. My question is pertaining to the type of fatty foods that are recommended CF patients eat to gain weight, with consideration around how that might trigger function of the pancreas, and if there's pancreatic insufficiency, plugged ducts. How does one balance overtaxing the pancreas that's already being challenged with trying to gain weight? Yes.
I think for the pancreatic insufficient patients, you know, there's really no function, almost no function of the pancreas anymore. So then you just really have to take your exogenous enzymes. And so the type of fat, I know this is very challenging because we really, I think, strive to be at the 50th to 75th percentile of BMI. So we, you know, and patients could be picky. So we don't necessarily restrict them, although we counsel them on the better types of fat. I mean, not eating Snickers all day long, you know, or those things, but at least eating the better ones, like you can have, those, I guess, nuts have fats that are better than bacon, I would say, but at least that. But I think the focus right now, there's really, again, our dietitians do not necessarily restrict them. We just counsel them. But in terms of, you're saying, the taxing the pancreas even more, I think at that point, really, when you're insufficient, there's really not much stress that you can do on the pancreas because the enzyme secretion is almost gone.
Hi, my name's Jen, and I have a 16-year-old with cystic fibrosis named Michael. And a few years back, he was diagnosed with a microbacteria abscessus, and I always wondered if being on azithromycin for so many years really opened the door to allow that other harmful bacteria to come in. Is there any correlation between the two? So I guess, Dr. Nichols, I'm looking right at you for that question.
Yeah, thanks for that. That's a very good question, and there were originally reports suggesting that azithromycin may affect certain white blood cells and their ability to manage or deal with mycobacterial infection. I will say too up front, azithromycin as a common therapy outside of those with NTM infection, so it's one of the antibiotics we commonly use to treat those infections, and so people who are found to have an NTM in their cultures, generally it's recommended that they stop their azithromycin. And I think that alone can confuse this issue, suggesting that perhaps that was a risk factor for them acquiring it. There was a very nice study looking at our U.S. population, partly in response to that paper I just mentioned, suggesting it could be a risk in the laboratory. And it indicated, in my view, pretty clearly that being on azithromycin reduced the risk of acquiring those NTM infections, almost like a chronic suppressive or protective therapy. Obviously, people still acquire these infections even though they're on azithromycin, but it seemed that overall those who were using azithromycin were actually less likely to get one of these infections to start with than those who were not using azithromycin. And those data, that general trend of toward protection, though not absolute, obviously, that general trend has been reproduced in other data sets. So I think many of us believe that using azithromycin is not a risk factor, perhaps has some protective effect, but if you do grow that infection, it's generally recommended that you stop your azithromycin until you might need to treat that infection. Okay.
Second part of that question is, they decided based on his lung function dropping to a baseline in the 60s, they wanted to treat for it. And at his age, he has an opinion. And this was a couple years ago, and he decided he would do the treatment, knowing all the risk of not treating. But he just wanted the summer really to be a kid. And he got involved a lot with exercise and running, and he took his lung function over the last couple of years from the 60s up to the 80s. And now he's training for the Chicago Marathon. So they decided to pull back on the treatment, so he hasn't had to go through with it. So the question is there a direct relationship between treating some of these harmful bacteria with additional exercise as opposed to some of these harmful bacteria?
Others are welcome to answer that too. This gets to the complexity of really understanding when one needs to treat these infections, right? And a big part of that determination is clinical decline. That's not responding to other treatments, so non-NTM based treatment. And so in this case, it sounds like your son, I'm very glad to hear, was able to apply some other non-NTM based treatments and see improvement in his overall health, which is great. And I think in a broad sense, that's what we'd like to see tried first, just because treatment can be so challenging. I'm not aware of any specific trial or test asking whether or not exercise or something like that may be beneficial, but broadly speaking, I would imagine it would.
They used to joke at Stanford they could tell when we had our conference because all the patients and parents would come in with like their list of things. And so my question is, my daughter, who's 24, started culturing small colony variants. I mean, always has staph, but the small colony variants that you were talking about. And her physician said, you know, I just read something that said there's this correlation with the azithromycin, and maybe we'll just take you off and see how that goes. So she came back and was no longer culturing this. Now, of course, we all know we'll wait it out and see if this is repeated. But I guess my question isn't about that bacteria per se, but to all the clinicians, I felt fortunate that her physician had read something. But what is the process for distributing this like best practices and sharing this knowledge? I mean, we all know NACFC, obviously, but what is the trigger when these studies come out? Is it upon each one of you to be just in everything else you do, to be constantly reading and updating and then shifting practice in clinic? Just curious how that works for you all.
Well, I can share my experience. So I think I'm fortunate that I am in an academic institution so that we have a lot of trainees who are very eager to learn, so they keep up with things. So at least for me to keep up with them, you know, I need to read up. But also, I think that being in a multidisciplinary team also helps, because when they read up on their things, I mean, they also, you know, share the information to the rest of the team, and it's not just you doing things in isolation. But I think and that's the reason why I think it's effective for us to have a single gastroenterologist taking care of those patients, so that at least you can try to standardize care and, you know, keep up with the knowledge that you have, but not saying that. I agree that sometimes, you know, we really have to disseminate information. I think that the CF Foundation is very good in doing that, but we need to do some more work for sure, especially to the community pediatricians.
That's a very good answer. I think it is incumbent on, any care provider, to try and keep up with the literature and the latest happenings. I think the real struggle is things that first come out get a lot of attention by human nature. I think that's true for a variety of disciplines beyond medicine. And you can sometimes jump in a little bit too fast. You know, you provided, you know, one example in the azithromycin. When that first paper came out, everybody was like, do we need to stop it on everybody? And then we did a deeper dive, and maybe the more definitive evidence came to light, where it was not causing atypical mycobacteria, not associated with atypical mycobacteria. So it's a constant challenge, but I think that is one of the great things about the community, as you said, both in the local microcosms of interacting with your peers, but also at a more national level where you can see what's emerging, see what's getting to be a consistent theme, when things cross over levels of evidence and summary statements, treatment guidelines are made, certainly those are all invoked, and we work really hard to invoke those when it reaches that level of evidence to do it as best as possible. But even that takes work and time and careful consideration with your peers on how to adopt.
My question revolves around DIOS, so probably directed to Dr. Garcia. Seeing a really high prevalence of DIOS post-transplant patients, and this is not just immediately post-transplant, but quite a few years out of transplant, so not necessarily due to pain medications or anything like that. I'm wondering if you can give some insight in terms of what may be causing that.
Yeah, so immediately, what I, you know, again, my disclosure is that I'm a pediatric gastroenterologist, so most transplant happens in, you know, adult centers. But from what I understand is that immediate post-transplant, there could be some underhydration that happens and because of also a lot of stress that happens to the body. So that may precipitate DIOS. But you're right, pain medication is one of them. And perhaps, I think that I'm not particularly sure really why it has an increase in incidence, but you're right, it has been there. And I think that we have to understand really, you know, what causes all these before I can really speculate on what's happening. Yeah.
I'm just a visitor on this panel. If Siri asks me, I say yes. But as the imposter, I'd like to weigh in on that question, and I just want to offer personal experience, but just generalize it here. It could be extremely large appetites after transplant and eating a lot more, prednisone induced. And then some people with transplant have a hard time with mobility and activity due to all of the impacts of the surgery and recovery and the medications. And I'm wondering if that's related as well. And also age is a correlation. I believe in end-stage lung disease and end-stage GI disease as we get older. So that's my personal experience.
Hi, my question is pertaining to the efficacy of fiber and some laxatives, maybe like Miralax, around really supporting preventing the backup and just the clayey substance that collects in the gut and causes the backup. I think there was something in the slide mentioning that there really isn't.
Yeah. The amount of fiber that you take in doesn't seem to have an associated correlation with whether or not you're going to have constipation. But polyethylene glycol, which is Miralax, actually is a very helpful preventive strategy for constipation and DIOS. So again, you're right. It's an osmotic laxative. It brings water in the stool to make it softer. But again, you know, we need a lot of higher dosing compared to the non-CF population just because of this decrease in fluid secretion that we see. So we just have to do that. So, sorry, did I answer your question? I wasn't sure.
Yes, and you mentioned that it really draws fluid to the gut to help with the movement. So that might cause dehydration in the patient. Is that true? And does it require a significant amount of additional water intake, something?
It does. And that's why we always say that Miralax has to be mixed in, or polyethylene glycol has to be mixed with the right amount of fluid. So it also helps that you have luminal fluid already, such that you're not doing that. And it's a very gentle osmotic laxative. It doesn't really cause a lot of large fluid shifts that would cause dehydration. So it's very safe to use. But we do advocate that patients really drink it with water, because otherwise it will not be effective.
Right. Thank you.
Good morning. My question is for Nadia. I enjoyed your presentation yesterday on motivating behavioral change, and recognize that that could be applicable to so many elements of our lives outside of CF. I have a child with ADHD that the whole time I was like, oh, this could be helpful, this could be helpful. So my question is, do you have any other like recommended resources that you could direct us to for more information on the topic?
Well, thank you for your question. I'm glad that you enjoyed the talk yesterday. And I think, again, it is, I agree, it's very applicable to a wide audience. I will say it's a pretty novel approach to be teaching it as a skill to parents. So as far as a parent-focused resource on motivational interviewing, I'm not aware of one that exists. There is a, I'm blanking on the author's name, but there is a book that's specific to using motivational interviewing with adolescents. It's got, I can see it. It's a black cover with a white daisy on it.
Someone do a Google search on that quick.
Yeah, and then I think one thing to think about with the motivational interviewing techniques that I talked about is, again, it's sort of a way of doing what you already do. And so there are certainly lots of resources about parent-child communication, about behavior management in young children or in adolescents. And so certainly lots of, you know, just general parenting resources that I think could be very applicable. So like one of the books that was on my slide, How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. There's also a teen version, How to Talk So Teens Will Listen and Listen So Teens Will Talk. And so I'd certainly be happy to share more resources. And again, I think depending on the types of issues or struggles you're having with your child. So, you know, sometimes it's adherence related, but sometimes the adherence related issues may be caused by or exacerbated by underlying issues with ADHD or behavior challenges or anxiety or depression. And so being able to think about, again, not just motivational interviewing as the intervention or the style or approach, but how to pair that with other types of strategies as parents and loved ones and working with folks to really have the best benefit.
So we have an 8-year-old daughter with cystic fibrosis, and we can handle the treatments pretty easily, but what we struggle with are the social factors. So the impact on her sleep, having to, again, try to force her to eat lots of food, and how that affects the rest of the family's schedule. So my question is there such a thing as too much treatment? Because we don't get to take a break away from the CF, but sometimes we do have to take a break from the treatment regimen. I'm also particularly interested in how Emily and Issa, as adults, with that feel, you know, feel how long can you walk away from that before you really start getting yourself in trouble?
That's a good question. So I really didn't start doing CF treatments until my teens because there were none. So it's a weird dynamic now to give advice to parents of kids who sit through hours of treatments every day because I never had to do that. It's all about time management, of course, but then there's a balance of letting your kid be a kid. And I presume there's a morning session with PT and inhaled meds, and then maybe something in the afternoon and then the evening, right? Yeah. Yeah. I kind of lived and learned the hard way, and as I grew older, I realized, like, I can get by a day without this medication, but I don't advocate that. But it's tough. I mean, your kid is a kid. They're not CF and a kid. They're a kid that happens to have CF, so you need to find that balance and never make it. One thing my parents did was never made it the focus of our life, ever. We would take family vacations with the vest that was 120 pounds. They'd throw it in the car, Crown Victoria to Florida, and that was it. I mean, we never dictated, Emily can't do this because she has to do, you know, chest CPD. We just did life, and I think it's vital, especially kids these days who are going to benefit from modulators and beyond, more therapies where they have to have the skills to become an adult and become an active part of society because they're going to have jobs and retire and have families. So if you focus too much on CF, they lose that experience. So I got a lot of experience under my belt from, and I think I can thank my parents for that. It really, really does help.
On that note, I do believe that treatments are, okay, first of all, I'm 47, so when I was a child, there were treatments. And
Mucal mist?
And,
I'm going to age in mucal mist.
And I think that I was at a different stage of CF, where if I didn't do my treatments, I felt the consequences right away. I would be coughing all day. I couldn't sleep through the night. So, of course, that's a great motivator. So things are very different now, where children feel fine. They don't have a consequence immediately of skipping treatments. So that's I acknowledge that's a very different situation. On the other hand, I believe that patterns and routines for all of us, habits, are just that. And if we break from a habit, such as this weekend, sitting in a chair for 48 hours, and I'm not active, my body is doing all kinds of weird things right now. So, and then we start saying, oh, it's so comfortable not to exercise, maybe I'm not gonna exercise tomorrow. Maybe I'm not gonna exercise next day. And it's so hard, I'm sure you all know, to get back into the routine and to the patterns. So I'm a huge believer in just making treatments non-negotiable and routine. And you can make them shorter. You can do them in the car. You can go for a swim instead of a vest treatment, adapting them in that way, so that it's not just so like the isolating medical experience, but sort of swimming with your friends for an hour becomes a treatment. But I know I'm just old and I'm telling you old person's advice back in my day, but I just think if you wanna go camping, if you wanna go traveling, to get one of those portable nebulizers so that it's just a normal part of life, like brushing our teeth.
Can I just add a little bit? So you mentioned about the feeding, because this was your first part of the question. So it is true that a lot of patients with chronic disease, not just CF, may have disordered eating patterns. You know, we advocate routine, as what Isa had said. So we tell parents not, you know, to have routine, breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks in between, no grazing, and limit meal times to 20 minutes and make it enjoyable. So everybody has to sit on a table, no TV, iPads, or any distractions, just to help them. You know, and I think that goes a long way to modeling for those kids. Your parents eating on a table 20 minutes tops, and then that's it. At least that also allows them time to have normal life or play, because if you're just feeding all day long, then it becomes a really a negative experience for the kid. And of course, for extreme cases, we do ask them to go to our feeding therapist or feeding team for help.
Thank you. So this is an online question for Dr. Garcia. Is from Melissa Schiffman. What causes dysmotility in patients who have not had the tissue issue before, and does it happen with age?
So dysmotility, I think there has been studies looking into this, whether it's really an effect from chronic inflammation or from the nerve itself being affected in CF, or medications that are being used. For instance, Zithromax has been seen to, we use it to increase gastric transit. So those things can affect motility. Your question is, does it advance over time? I think that I'm actually not sure of the question. It's a very, the answer to that, it's very complicated, because there's not just one thing that, we're looking at. So you're looking at the role of infections, the role of bacterial load, the role of antibiotics, and the CF itself. So I think that, again, as with a lot of GI conditions in CF, we really need to study a lot more about, what's happening in CF patients.
was a, like just this great segue, because there is so much about the gut. Mm-hmm. And I actually would just want to observe that you're getting a lot of questions here, because the gut is just this huge issue. I just, I'm curious what you, have you have any thoughts on the low FODMAP diet?
Of what, sorry?
The low FODMAP diet, are you familiar?
Oh, low FODMAP diet. Okay, so low FODMAP diet, for all of you, is a treatment that we use for irritable bowel syndrome or functional abdominal pain. Now, it is a very restrictive diet. So if you actually look at the low FODMAP, you know, you're eliminating almost half of what you normally eat. So we do not advocate it for patients. Again, there's no evidence that it helps patients with CF. And I think that we have to be very careful into using that, because again, you have to balance that they have to get proper nutrition and reach their, you know, BMI goal. So my experience with low FODMAP for other non-CF population that who have functional abdominal pain, they actually do, we see decrease in weight on when you do it. So I think it's very hard, especially in the pediatric population. You know, you don't want them to be very picky as well. So we don't use it for CF.
That's really interesting, because the adult CF clinic that I go to advocates that quite a bit.
No, again, as I said, you know, there is no strong evidence for it, but I think that if you have ruled out other things, other conditions that are causing your abdominal complaints, and you're really left with IBS or functional abdominal pain, that you may want to try that. But again, be very cautious about, very careful about doing it.
So, go ahead.
Yeah. I just wanted to add that we do appreciate how perhaps GI symptomatology will deserve an increased focus now and in the days ahead, and perhaps it's a recognition that we haven't done that as well as we could have, thinking so much about the lungs and sinuses and infection and particularly CFTR. So for those who may be interested, there over the last 3 years, I would say the foundation and the TDN have organized a group of GI specialists who think about CF across the United States, and increasingly enlarging that group. It's called Digest, which is appropriate, I think. But anyway, they have their first study ongoing now, which is to begin to understand what are the symptoms that capture the experience of people with CF across ages, using questionnaires that you can take through your smartphone. Many of you may have participated. It's called the Galaxy Study. It was predicted to enroll 400 people in 12 months, and it enrolled 370 people in 2 months. So clearly there's a lot of interest in this. That's remarkable. That will be used in the PROMISE study that Steve and I are co-leading with several other great investigators, including GI specialists. And we'll understand through that what gets better on these modulator drugs that are expected to come in the next several months. And I think that will be important for us to say, okay, how much is better, how much is remaining, and where can we target our focus in the GI manifestations. And as those drugs are approved in lower and lower ages, we hope that that will be extended downward. So it doesn't go unrecognized. We may be catching up a little bit, but we'll focus on that.
Well, I really don't know who to address this to, because it wasn't addressed in any of the presentations, but there are so many hereditary genetic things that you can do nowadays. Well, one of my friends sent in his sputum to have a hereditary ancestry, you know, genetic testing and all that good stuff. And they sent it back and it said it was indecisive. Now he is on the eye catheter, all of the stuff for the CF gene. Would that interfere with any of the other genetic testings, like for ancestry and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think you're talking about people that are doing genetic sequencing and analysis to try and figure out their heredity and pattern. And there's really no reason to think that any drug should affect the applicability of those tests or results from those tests, because because they don't alter the gene or the genome that's assessed. So my guess is that might be something else going on. Certainly you have to have good material, good DNA material for those tests to work well. People with CF can have inflammation of the epithelial surface. Some of them get blood, some of them get swabs. Blood should work fine. If you were to get a swab from the mucosa or something, I could see that inflammation just from CF could impact the quality of the DNA. But my guess is simply resampling would allow you to get to the answer on that. I think there is a future towards sequencing, impacting medical decision making in cystic fibrosis and trying to figure out what all the rest of the genome might impact it. Of course, you may know that there's already been searches for genetic modifiers, and some of those may be therapeutic targets, and that's going forward. But that really only tested for expressing genes, and we're now learning expressing genes are actually a minority of the genome. Like all your DNA, most of it is actually non-coding and does a lot of really important things in turning other genes on and off. So there's starting to be efforts to use that sequencing information to try and find out what else might be impacting people with CF and their outcomes, and ultimately, can we intervene on it?
Very interesting question. Issa, go
that's
ahead.
Okay. May I ask a question? Yeah. For Dr. Rowe, I don't think this has been addressed yet, but what is the experience around using modifiers in people post-transplant? And then later, I have a question for Dr. Garcia.
We heard a little bit about that when Jerry mentioned it and his experience with it. So I think it's emerging area. There's no definitive information that I have seen. I've looked for it from time to time, apropos trying to keep updated for evidence from others. I would say there's two major things to think about. One is the modulators do have interaction profiles, and they will interact with other medications, including Prograf and cyclosporine, which are very commonly used and the most important medicines for suppressing rejection. So I think you would not want to use that willy-nilly and without careful consultation with your transplant providers, because there's a good chance it will. I mean, it's expected that use of these CFTR modulators would affect cyclosporine and Prograf levels, which are so critical. However, there's also good reason to believe that CFTR modulators might help things for people who have had a post-transplant. Jerry mentioned, and I completely agree, that perhaps the most important one is its impact on sinus health, and because the infections that occur in the sinuses often drain down to the lung and go back and forth. And if we know there's early evidence that CFTR modulators are helping sinus disease, so if you could change the bacterial patterns that are there in the sinuses, that you could foresee that might benefit the lungs. And we don't really know all the causes of rejection, but clearly infection is part of it. So that's one. And then second, of course, is the whole person. And hopefully, as these CFTR modulators get better and better, we're going to, in fact, help other organs, the GI system being one of them, perhaps, endocrine system, probably, other aspects. So one could foresee that they could be useful in that regard. What are we doing? Well, I think it's pretty mixed. Even in our center, we have some patients with CF who are candidates for modulators that are on them and some that aren't. And it's really been made on an individual basis. We've tended to avoid using them very early because of the rejection is so important early. And you can also start to get a pattern for how rejection is occurring or not occurring in that individual. And then later on, these medicines, when the levels of Prograf and cyclosporine, you kind of can make better predictions about what that patient needs and what adjustments might be needed. So it's a moving target and one that requires careful attention and communication with your provider.
May I ask the second question to Dr. Garcia? I'm sorry, see.
And that is about the colorectal cancer screening. You had listed esophageal, hepatobiliary, small bowel, all of these GI cancers that are higher risk, and colon is just one of them. And so all of this stuff about the screening is really based on a colonoscopy. And I'm curious, even though you're pediatric, if you have some ideas of whether other kinds of screening are warranted, such as imaging. And also the risk, I didn't see on your list anything about family history.
Yes, I think that, so right now we only have the colorectal screening guidelines or recommendations from the CFF, but I mean, in general, there is really no, even in the non-CF population, there's no screening guideline for those other gastrointestinal cancers. So it's really based on symptoms. But I think that what providers or gastroenterologists should realize is that, you know, that they should know that patients with CF are at higher risk, such that you can screen early, but there's really nothing that would tell you to do it on a yearly basis. So I think it's an individual case-by-case basis to do those things. Yeah, I mean.
Now, Sarah.
This is a question for every member of the panel, which is, I'm really curious what in each of your settings, where you go for care or where you practice, about your mental health support services for patients and who's embedded on your team, social worker, psychiatrist, clinical psychologist, how is that working and whether these programs, because I know many were launched with grants initially from the CFF, and I'm just curious how many are able to sustain these into the future.
I'll go first. I think it's nice that we're finally recognizing this, and I think I talked about that the other night, because it plays such a role in caring for yourself in general, but then also caring for yourself with treatments, right? So if your mind isn't healthy, it can go into a rabbit hole of, well, then I'm not going to do my treatments. Why do I do my treatments? I'm not going to live. I mean, these are just thoughts that I'm sure have hit a lot of people in the CF community. So it's nice. I think there's a psychiatrist in my clinic now. I don't know if I've seen her. I think I've been on a conference call with her once. But so for my clinic, it's the social worker comes in, and we talked the other day about I'm safe at home. Because we don't have that mindset, at least my generation doesn't yet, that in my experience of discussing mental health in the CF setting, right? There's still a stigma attached to mental health across the country. We need to get better with that as a nation and embrace it and not look at it like it's a bad thing, because that's how I felt for so long. Like, sure, I have bad lungs, and sure, I tore my Achilles tendon, but let's not talk about my mind, okay? Because it's still stigmatized, right? So I think as we get more comfortable, it's going to be easier, and I'm happy they're starting at such a young age now, just opening that door. But for me, the door really still isn't open unless I bring it up to my CF physician, but the social worker is kind of just doing a wellness check on me, I think. Yeah.
So in our center, or in our hospital, there everybody gets a depression screening from ages 12 onwards. So whether or not you have CF, you get that screening. So I think that the hope is that we can capture everybody who has mental health issues from ages 12 and above. So that's the first line. And if they pass that, our social worker always talks to patients about this. And the good thing about, I think, that the CF center is that, or being in a CF center, is that you follow those patients from birth all the way up. So you kind of know those families. You get to know them really well, including, you know, their social structure, support, and all those things. So our social worker talks to everybody, and if they flag them for some mental health issues, then they get referred to an appropriate behavioral health team. Now, we don't have a psychiatrist in our CF group as of yet. I don't know if that's going to happen, but as far as I understand, there is a need for more mental health providers across the nation. So that's clearly a need for everyone, such that it may be really difficult to have a psychiatrist really, like, you know,
just for our the CF patients, but we do have resources that we provide for everybody. Now, for patients who are experiencing care burnout, we also have our palliative, we call them the palliative care team, but really it's not for palliative care. It's really more for support for the families, you know, to hear their expectations and to, you know, to clarify their care and, you know, their role in it, and, you know, just to provide support.
I mentioned I got my start as a camp counselor for people with special health needs, including CF, and so it seems really obvious because that was that intense bond of counseling in that role of people with CF that brought me into the community. So it seems very obvious that would be needed, especially in the most challenging years of your life, which is adolescence and young adulthood. So our practices, we have a social worker who does universal screening for depression annually, or other barriers that we need to know about, and then subsequently through a grant from the CF Foundation, they've received our social workers receive special medical counseling training, and then offers that to anybody that's screening positive and interacts with them both either in person or with more comprehensive telephone interviews, and there's group versions and non-group versions. And then we've associated our clinic with professional psychotherapists that are also, willing and interested in seeing our referral population. So we use that. It's important to know that depression is a more common problem in people with CF. I think that's probably true for many, many chronic diseases. And certainly we observe that. There's also a moving target with new therapies. I think there's been case reports and also dialogue about the risk of CF modulators potentially contributing to depression in some individuals. So it's important to think about as therapies change. We don't really understand the mechanism of that or how the strength of that association. It may be a small number of people, but I think we need to watch that. And I think the other two points I was going to make about this is that the other moving target. Just I'm also a parent of young children. And certainly social media could be really powerful for CF, especially with the infection control procedures concerns, to allow people to come together and share stories and get support from one another. But I also, just in watching social media and reading about it, I think you also, as a parent or as a person, have to really figure out, okay, what's the right balance? Because it can also be so destructive, especially for girls. And so you're gonna have to balance that. And then last is, I missed the talk on, because I was in the science session on mindfulness meditation, but I think I've taken it up personally, and I've recommended it strongly to a lot of our patients, so I think that's a really good mental health tool for a lot of people, including me.
So, I have worked in two pediatric CF care centers, Virginia Commonwealth Universities and University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And in both of those centers, there was at least one social worker and a clinical psychologist, and also the presence of psychology trainees, which was me in both of those settings. And so I think the use of trainees in these settings is, one, an incredible opportunity for mental health professionals who are in their training still to get incredibly valuable experience. And so not only thinking about providing care in these settings, but also increasing the workforce of mental health professionals that are familiar with CF. So I think that's one thing that a lot of centers do, and more centers ought to kind of think about doing, because it's, again, it's free labor. People want the experience when they're a trainee. It's an awesome opportunity and experience. I think some of the things that are drawbacks about that are kind of continuity of care. So you're only there for, a year-long rotation, or sometimes 2 years. And so in both of the settings where I worked, there was kind of a long-standing social worker or a psychologist that was kind of a mainstay in the clinic, and then the addition of trainees that were there to help with things like depression and anxiety screenings, providing consultation and intervention while someone was there during an inpatient stay, and also providing some outpatient follow-up therapy. I think some of the challenges, especially with outpatient follow-up therapy, is the distance from CF care clinics, the stigma in pursuing mental health treatment, the demands of medical treatment for CF as it is. So kind of, where do I have time to figure out where I fit in an outpatient therapy visit once a week or once every other week? And kind of difficult to make progress in outpatient therapy when you're only seeing the psychologist or the social worker in your clinic maybe once every 3 months, and it's in the context of a very busy clinic visit. And so figuring out where to kind of carve out that time for it. And so I think there's a lot of discussion and a lot of increase in telemental health and mental health support groups online. So I think that's one avenue. Again, I think I'm glad that you mentioned the NACF grants for mental health coordinators. Those were 3-year grants. And so a lot of places are starting, the funding for it is running out now. And I think one thing that people in the mental health field within kind of pediatric medical settings have to think about is not just how do we make this an ongoing service that's available because of grants, but how do we make this sustainable, kind of like a financially viable service that we provide. And so oftentimes it's kind of bundled in as part of your CF clinic services that are offered, but it's not necessarily something that is billed. And so that is kind of an increasing conversation or dialogue about mental health coverage, how this can be covered and then sustained financially. We did a lot of things in our clinics as far as kind of having referrals, knowing who in different parts of the state had experience working with pediatric medical populations and had experience working with CF patients before, so being able to have those resource lists, because again, oftentimes distance to clinic was a barrier. Also having kind of self-help resources, so book recommendations for parents or self-help books for adolescents, and then also apps and different things that are out there, like ones that teach kind of mindfulness skills like Headspace and Calm.com, and there's like tons and tons of them. So giving people different tools that aren't necessarily psychotherapy, but are still kind of mental health skill building tools that they can use. So I was grateful to work in places where there was that mental health support, but you know, it's not everywhere. So you gotta get creative sometimes.
I wanna add a whole lot. We've taken a similar approach, mental health coordinator in our clinic, social worker, longstanding relationships there. I would echo what Emily said. I think mental health is perhaps one of the strongest or most impactful factors in how you do with the rest of your CF. And so there is an increased appreciation for that. I think that's obvious based on the programs. The sustainability of that is gonna be critical. And I don't know that it's practical to expect a foundation of any sort to continue to provide for that across the country. I can't speak to that, but that seems like a stretch. What I did want to add was this, is I think many of you all as family members and parents are also, and perhaps the best suited at identifying early some signals of concern. And we're busy in these clinics and we're concerned about you being there for 3 or 4 hours at a time and getting everybody in to see you. So if this is a real concern for you, please speak up and tell your provider that you know you're really worried about this, and that can help us prioritize our time and make sure that the mental health coordinator or the social worker or someone else connects with you on that issue on that day, so we don't miss that opportunity. And last thing I'll say is I will apologize. I have to run and get a shuttle, but I'm gonna step away. So thank you all again for the chance to be here.
I don't have too much to add except just personal perspective. There's so much attention given to mental health, and I think that's so important and wonderful. But I also feel like sometimes there's a sort of search for what's wrong, and anxiety and depression are diseases that need to be treated with medication. And sometimes I think we just don't acknowledge as much the grief involved in CF, and that grief is a normal, natural response to a series of losses that happen in CF. And that sometimes I think the only medication for grief, there is no medication, is support from other people and being heard and understood, whether that's from parents or a therapist or friends or a sports club or the CF community. So that's really all I have to share. There's no fix here. Life is full of grief. And I think just to acknowledge that, the big difference being depression is like not valuing or feeling any worth in yourself, whereas grief is feeling worth in yourself, but just feeling bummed that you can't do things or that you've lost lung capacity or if you've lost this job or whatever that loss is because of CF.
Great, thank you.
Go ahead. Hi, I have a 3-year-old granddaughter who has CF. My question is on the parents of CF patients. Are there any studies which who have studied some conditions or later on diseases developing in the parents who have mutated genes, like the carriers of mutated genes?
People are looking for associations of carrier status with disease. It's been reported that people who are carriers have a higher risk of chronic sinusitis. That might be one, you know, manifestation. Risks for other diseases would not surprise me. And you know, we're working with COPD risk factors. Not everybody who smokes gets COPD. Might CFTR be a risk factor? That's been reported in some, but not all data. Those are the two that I think of in terms of a disadvantage to being a carrier.
Can I just add purely anecdotal, because looking at this room, I'd be curious about a study for increased risk of colon cancer in CF carriers. I don't know if there has been any literature, but just it seems to be a pattern that I've noticed.
Wait, I gotta chime in on this. So I'm starting this little hashtag, test the parents. So my dad is 6'7", fathered 3 kids, but had 2 positive sweat tests in the past couple years. But he's on Medicare, and Medicare won't pay for genotyping because nobody that old is being tested for CF. So we always test the siblings right away when there's a diagnosis, but we never test the parents. So are we missing the mark? I'm a little crazy, you know that. But like, I have this vision that, I mean, I know several adults my age whose parents were recently diagnosed in their 60s and 70s. So why can't we get a huge grant? So kids are tested and diagnosed. Why don't we test the parents? It's a cost thing, but there could be thousands of more people out there. And we always say men are 97% infertile, right? But that's only testing people who are diagnosed. Mm-hmm. So I challenge a big farmer to give me a lot of money so we can test all the parents.
Is it on?
Yes.
Okay. You could probably look to the Johns Hopkins folks for help with that. So.
Okay. I have a question. I look at some of the CF Facebook, which you have to be very wary of. And it just is like a pet peeve of mine to hear people not taking them or saying, hey, I didn't take my modulator for a couple of days. Is that okay? Or, you know, what do I do? And other people have gone, oh, yeah, I missed 2 weeks worth. Or, you know, and it's just, it drives me crazy. Can you address the rebound phenomenon with modulators? Yeah, or not taking modulators?
This has really been reported most for ivacaftor and G5-1D. Perhaps it's just because of the longer time that it's been available, but also the effects are more prominent, as we've already discussed. And what's been reported is, in some case series, so this is just a collection of anecdotes. It's not systematic data that has a high level of evidence, but it's still often what comes out first, and then we understand further, is that people who abruptly stop, especially after they've been on it for a long time, can have risk of a substantial worsening. And in at least one case, it was associated with a terrible infection that resulted in intensive care unit and then ultimately the patient's death. So the other cases that were reported in that series were just severe exacerbations that required a more intense therapy than even usual to try and bring them back up. And nobody really knows what's happening here. One possibility is that your body does start to accommodate for the new normal of having at least some CFTR active, and then when that goes away, the body is just not as prepared to deal with all the mucus and inflammation, infection, et cetera, all the other problems that might then collapse on itself. I would say, the other thing that's going on is certainly when people have taken these, especially in the highly active category, is they're like, wow, I did not know how bad I was until I know what I am now. And I think you described a little bit of that. And so then you then perceive the new decline, the decline differently than you would have if you had never experienced that. And so that may be part of it as well. I don't think we know for sure. So whether that's going to happen with a triple or not is totally unknown. Obviously, in the early phase testing, people did stop, but those were after 20-day exposure periods, and I think now the understanding is this is really more of a problem with super long exposures where this could occur. Having said that, there was some early on-off type studies with ivacaftor, and there was at least some of those patients in these early trials that did experience, they felt like they were even worse after they stopped, and I don't think we understand if that's real or if that was part of this perception that I talked about. Mm-hmm. So I would just say that there's good reason to be cautious. I've certainly had super perceptive patients say, I know when I miss and I'm late, or even by an hours or days. But then there are certainly many other cases, and the medical possession ratios, which is how many times people fill it, suggest that, like a lot of other medicines, people do miss them. So, I think it's still emerging. I think I would be cautious.
Mm-hmm. Can I chime in on that?
Yes.
As somebody who's been on Kalydeco for 10 years, one example is I did have to stop it once to rule out a side effect when I was in the clinical trial, and I just plummeted, like, PFDs down to 50 and in the hospital, like, within 3 days. But as we speak to modulators, specifically Kalydeco, and as we evolve into the triple combo, we have to be very cautious and pay attention. Getting back to mental health, people losing the identity that they've had of being sick. And people always ask me, why wouldn't you take Kalydeco? Not me, but why would this person not take it? Why would they not take it? It's so easy, it's a pill. But you're not the person living with CF. So from what I've discovered with discussions and just observations is people are losing that identity of being sick and in the hospital and always getting attention, and you're taking that away from them, which to everyone else is amazing because you have a life now. So I think we really have to be cautious and pay attention to our patients with the mental health aspect of this. Sure, these drugs are going to be life-changing, but in those life changes, they're going to be freaking out because now they have to build a future in a family retirement fund. They might not have the skills for that because they dropped out of college, or they didn't even go to college because they didn't think they're going to be alive, and now it's a pill that they take twice a day that they're going to be like, shit, I don't have any skills for a job or a career. So being really mindful of what's about to happen in the CF community, I think, is very important, and social workers and mental health is going to be even bigger than it is now, I think.
What's the opinion on things like Medicare for All and all of that whole can of worms?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we have now for me is working. So I'm up for anything that's going to make sure we have coverage. I don't really have an opinion.
I think
think that's a bigger question that I'm prepared to answer. Obviously, because I'm not a health policy expert, but CF is going to be hailed as both the good and the risks of modern medicine. And the good is obviously that we're addressing underlying manifestations. It came from this huge backlog of science. There's other supportive cares that are hitting very early into the pathogenesis. You know, what accomplishments, and that it's impacting people now in a more wide basis. You know, what accomplishments, hopefully gene therapy and other forms of gene nucleotide delivery will also cross that threshold, and that will be another major milestone scientific achievement, and probably hearken other diseases, including other lung diseases, to take the same path. So that's the pro, right? But the negative is, okay, what about the cost here? And it's not going to be sustainable for all these rare diseases to have tremendously expensive therapies. I think we're even getting better and better at taking large diseases and finding boutique populations or specific populations to treat them. And they will come with potentially medicines only available to a small number of people that are therefore very, very expensive to develop. What are we gonna do? I think we don't know that yet, but we're gonna have to change.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes. Since Siri had a second question, I thought I'll ask one other question too. you just mentioned about gene therapy and CRISPR technology you mentioned yesterday. So do you have any idea as to how far we are from when they start do the phase 1, phase 2 study for cystic fibrosis with gene therapies or gene editing more likely?
Oh, well, I mean, this new era of gene-based therapies is definitely evolving super fast. So I'm not going to make any predictions about exactly when that's going to occur. But I would say, like, already there's been nucleotide therapies. So these are, like, delivering the messages that have shown some benefit in some outcomes but not others in CF. There's been there's ongoing a full-length CFTR message studies that are happening, you know, right now, and that we're involved in, and so you know, results will hopefully be reported as they emerge, and you know, that so those are earlier because you don't have to get the gene in permanently. There are you know, several companies that are developing the classic gene therapy where you put in the DNA and it goes in permanently. But there's a lot of challenges too, like which cells do you have to hit, and can you get through the mucus, and can it be safe? Can it be sustained, or is it only going to be transient? We're so good at blocking viruses and other foreign DNA. The lung is designed to do that. Viruses are foreign DNA. We're designed to get rid of them. So how are those hurdles going to be accomplished? I think there's a lot more science to be done there. So those seem to be longer term than what I spoke to, and then gene editing is probably, to me, as challenging as DNA delivery, because we're not going to be able to fix CF out in the test tube and then put it back in. That seems like a long way off. So rather, we're going to have to fix it in the lungs of the person, you know, while they're doing well, and not screw up their potential to be on other therapies that might be working. So I think the gene editing technology, the potential power of this in many, many diseases is going to push, the science is going to be pushing forward really strongly. And success in other diseases is a success for us, because those lessons will then be applied, even if the lung is a more challenging situation. But I see nucleotide therapy potentially shorter term, intermediate term, I would say, and gene editing or gene replacement. Those are, you know, 5 and 10 year time horizons, I would guess.
All right. Okay.
Okay, I'm going to ask this question of Emily and Issa, but Emily, I got to check with you. I'm mindful of your time because you got to catch
over.
Okay, perfect. And my question, it came up at the mother's retreat. Huge topic was siblings, that we talk a lot about the individuals with CF, we talk about the caregivers, and the poor siblings quite often seem to be left out in the cold. And I can tell you from my own son, who's 20, he carries a lot of anxiety about his sister's health, and I do know he has sacrificed tons of time with me when the time to test was in the hospital. So I'm curious if both of you could address, since I know you both have siblings.
Go, Issa.
Gosh, I don't, excuse me. I don't know how to answer that, except that I believe that my brother is very resilient, and that he pursued his own path. He was really active in sports and surfing and skiing, and had his Boy Scout troop. He had an outlet for himself. That being said, I think CF profoundly changed his upbringing. And as my parents age, his burden is greater. And as the soul healthy, you know, I'm healthy, thankfully, but sort of fragile still. And I guess there's so much to do with this disease. There's so much to think about. And like life, we have to triage all the time. And so it is unfair. It is unfortunate. It is a loss for my brother to have been left out. But to this day, he still denies that there was any problem for him. And he denies it wasn't CF, it was my parents that made his life hard. So of course he's gonna say something like that. He's also, like, he brings a lot of humor into the household, and just that was his coping response. And when my sister died, he was really, of course, he's stoic and he's learned to be stoic. He was just like, she lived an amazing life. She put 80 years into 40 years, and he was grateful. So he learned how to cope over the years. I hope all siblings out there have the privilege of growing older with their siblings and being able to grow and learn from the CF path rather than always seeing it as the problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. So my brothers are both older than me, and early on they were involved in the chest percussion therapy a little bit, but they were more involved with me with stuff outside of CF, so skateboarding and playing basketball. And my middle brother was a football player and wrestler, so I was always the manager on the football team, so I got to spend tons of time with him. And my other brother was a guitar player, so we started playing rock and roll music together, and I lived with him. And I never saw them or felt like they looked or felt left out. I mean, my middle brother's more sensitive, so whenever I would go in the hospital, my mom told me that he would get anxious and worried about me. But I think, like you say about your brother, they grew into their own. I mean, one's a cop, one lives in Florida, they're crazy. We have a good time together. We never talk about CF. I mean, doesn't even come up unless I'm sick and they're like, how you doing? Aside from that, we just have fun, and it's kind of awesome, right? Because they're two big brothers that will protect me forever, but we just have a good time, and I should have that conversation with them now about the past and how they feel now and how they felt with us growing up. But I think me being able to benefit from Kaleidico has maybe brought a big sense of relief to them. So now I'm the one that makes them run and get off their butts and exercise. So it's just cool. I mean, it really is a family disease, right? But again, we never made it a focus of our family. So and that's my advice to everyone else, is like, get your kid, other children, if you have them, involved in their care a little bit, but then send them out on their bikes to the store and tell them to come back in 3 hours and just have fun as siblings and live a normal life.
I just want to clarify, because I didn't mean to dog my parents there, but I guess if I was going to say accurately what was the number one predictor of my brother's health and mental health, it was my parents' emotional health. So how they coped or didn't cope was really the factor that influenced him. Of course, duh, that's the case for all of us. But our disease per se, you know, the time commitment, the hospital visits. That was hard, but I think if a if the parents are coping in an open and healthy manner and adjusted and not avoidant and communicating and balanced in their lives, then that's gonna influence the kid.
Oh. Thank you, Emily. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I was wondering, Dr. Islam, if you wanted to comment on that about siblings and parents and who are not affected.
Yes. Yeah,
physically.
So I agree that CF does affect the whole family, but it doesn't have to be the focus of the family. So a lot of what I end up counseling parents on is a big fear or concern aside from CF and how CF is affecting their child with CF is worrying about the siblings and how the other siblings are coping and how to still make sure that they're giving time and attention to the other siblings. And so this is oftentimes a huge topic of working with parents of kids with CF. And I wholeheartedly agree with the things that Issa and Emily have said about just normalizing the experience of like not putting CF first, but family first, and making CF care sort of part of your family's routine and life, that it's just sort of a normal part of your family's routine, getting your siblings involved in your care and making sure that you're still doing fun things as a family. And, again, fortunately in the centers where I worked, we were also available as mental health professionals to work with siblings. And so I was oftentimes working with siblings of patients with CF, or I would be working with a CF patient, another one of our mental health professionals would be working with a sibling. So just knowing that there's support available for everyone in the family, and making sure that you are tuned in to how your other children are kind of coping with the illness and not making assumptions. I think that's a huge thing that I, kind of going back to motivational interviewing, kind of asking those open-ended questions, not assuming that they're anxious or assuming that they feel left out or assuming that they, are bothered, because you don't know. So just kind of having some of those open conversations with, as a family about how everyone is doing, I think is really, really important. And then again, all of those tools we talked about yesterday, kind of validating emotions, reflecting their experience, not always having to fix it or make it better, but just, acknowledging and recognizing this is a disease that affects the entire family. I think I hope that more centers have support available for siblings as well.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Well, that brings us to close here. Many thanks to our now shrunken panel, but it's still, thank you for those who stayed and for Issa for filling in. And, we really thank you all for staying here and sharing your expertise and insights.